Hall.
Yeah,
So
let's
maybe we
just
can
get
pick
to
up there.
the good part. Yeah. So our march from the school board went to City Hall. We surged in. There must have been a somewhere between well over 100 of us. We demanded to talk to the mayor or to somebody from city council. We were told at that point that City Hall was closed, but we were completely occupying, I think, the whole building, at least the whole first floor entryway. And it was peaceful, largely peaceful. Certainly nobody got hurt, but there was just one story I remember is that my girlfriend Katie Rubio, whose background was similar to mine, we didn't discover this till later, but she decided on her own to go upstairs to the women's bathroom and started flushing rolls of toilet paper down it to sort of disable the bathrooms, and I found myself standing right by the switchboard, which was an old-fashioned switchboard like you see in movies with the operator plugging plugs into things, and I saw there was one main communication plug that went in to the switchboard, and I decided, I don't think there was discussion about this nor any opposition to it. I decided that I should disconnect the switchboard in terms of bringing City Hall to a halt until they agreed to speak with our group. And so I reached over to pull the plug out. The receptionist sort of put her hand on the back of the plug to keep me from pulling it out. I was very careful. We never touched, or there was no threatening words between us. I was trying to disconnect it. She was trying to keep me from disconnecting it. And then there, I looked up, and there was a Chester policeman there, and he was saying, "Get your hands off of that." And I was saying, I need to disconnect this." And then I looked down, and I saw his knuckles holding his billy club
Oh,
were
no.
white with and so I always had a preservation instinct, so at that point I just thought, I'm about to get my head busted here, so I gave up on trying to disconnect the switchboard. But over that, both that day, they then just started arresting us. It was including a lot of kids, and there was roughing up, including against the kids, when the arrests were made. I cannot remember how we got transported, but we got transported out to the county prison, which I think was called Broadmoor, out in the country. So one of these grand old, I don't, not grand, but big old prisons out there in some field, pretty close to Chester and Swarthmore. They didn't have room for us, so they did something which, in retrospect, was fascinating. This was still the days when, if you didn't pay your child support, the most likely thing a judge was going to do was put you in jail for 30 days until you, and then said, "You better pay it or you'll be back in jail." So they had a bunkhouse where these guys, I guess they were considered low risk, whatever you call it, low, yeah. So they were all in one room, and they got moved out. I don't know if they got just let out of prison or if they put them somewhere else. So we were all put in this room. I don't think we did. We stay overnight. I can't remember that part. You'll have to do some more interviews. I do remember us being convinced that they put saltpeter in the food. I don't even hardly know what that was, but I think it was something that was supposed to sort of dope you up and make you less violent. So we were hesitant to eat the food. And over a period of that day, and then the next day in came a lot more Swarthmore students. So a total of 240 people were arrested, of which 57 were Swarthmore students. Mm-hmm. And long story short, from that, all the charges were dropped and we were all just let out. And we're out in the country. So I can remember just the ride from there back to Swarthmore. Somebody had a VW van and we just stacked ourselves in there. We were sort of practically lying on top of each other, but very joyous to be getting out. And the end of that story is that the school board had previously passed a budget to repair a bunch of schools. There was nothing in it for Franklin, but they agreed to close Franklin School and reassign the students to better schools. So, and I can't tell you history of whether that actually came to pass. I don't know. So now I should add here. Okay, on November 22nd of this month, Kennedy was assassinated. Mm-hmm. So that was a traumatic moment for all of us. Should I describe that a little bit?
Sure. Yeah, we'd love to hear your response and your experience.
Yeah. Well, I can remember two things. One is, okay, now I forget these buildings I'm going to refer to don't exist. There was something we called Somerville. It was a little building right off of Parrish, which got torn down to build the new library, I think. Anyway, it had a lounge upstairs and a little snack bar downstairs. None of us had TVs, definitely not TVs in our room. I don't even think we had TVs in the lounges of dorms anymore. So we all were just gathered around this this TV watching the funeral procession, watching the news, and a lot of people were rather weepy. And then I also can remember us sitting out on the lawn in front of Parrish having a conversation. Now, we were all intelligent Swarthmore students, but somebody said, well, God, who's going to be president now? And somebody else said, Lyndon Johnson. And Lyndon Johnson, that somebody else said, oh, that can't be. They can't make Lyndon Johnson president. He's a complete buffoon. He was nominated as part of a deal to get Kennedy nominated. And then, I'll bring this into the... So as I recall, Kennedy was shot on a Friday, and Monday was the national day of mourning, and I think the day is the funeral was. But, okay, back in these days, there were only three deans. There was the dean of students, the dean of men, the dean of women. I guess there was a provost. That was it. So the dean of students, Susan Cobb, decided that with students being very freaked out and weepy, the best way to get us all back in shape was to start up classes on Monday. I can just remember going into my music class, which was a big class, 200 people, and our music teacher, Mr. Swing, saying, I will not, this is a day of mourning for our president, I refuse to teach, and walked out. That was the end of that class. That's the only one I remember. Okay, now let me just talk a little bit about the college administration's reaction to this.
Sure.
Even though, you know, as I said, it was very very different than, you know, it's very different from sitting in the president's office, but hang on a sec, I'm just looking for something I want to describe to you, and I actually got myself kind of organized last night, okay. They brought in Carl Whitman, Dean Cobb did, and basically said this stuff has to stop, somehow threatened him, he said, with expulsion if this didn't stop. And so then November 19th, out came the following letter, which is not that long, and I somehow got a copy of it to you, signed by all three deans. To all Swarthmore students, the college feels that it owes its students a clear understanding of its policy on matters that have to do with off-campus social or political action. At the time of last week's events in Chester, which was that mass arrest I just told you about, the college expressed itself public as follows. Quote, college students have the same rights as all citizens to express and act upon their social concerns as individuals. They also have the same responsibilities as all citizens to obey the law. A college is committed to rational processes and orderly procedures and seeks to convey an understanding of this commitment to its students. It also seeks to remind its students of their obligations as registered students with given academic responsibilities such as class attendance and study, unquote. To that statement, we would add the reminder of an established college policy, namely, that students in this situation, as in any other, may be subjected to disciplinary action for acts contrary to law or for their neglect of their obligations as members of the college. We wish to reemphasize the important differences between socially responsible procedures and those which are violent or which tend to lead to violence, and to reaffirm the fact that the first business of the members of a college community, students as well as faculty, is the continued success of the academic program. Signed, Susan Cobbs, Dean Robert Parr, Dean of Men, Barbara Lang, Dean of Women. It seemed extreme to us. I must say, I don't recall it slowing us down in any way. But it was just, and this was from the college administration. Now, meanwhile, the college faculty that I recall were much more sympathetic, and I remember once I had missed a math midterm in calculus and going to the professor and him saying, I don't know if he said, I admire what you're doing, but he basically said, okay, no problem, we'll just reschedule the exam. And so I don't remember any opposition from the faculty, mm-hmm. except that Mr. Gilbert, the head of the political science department, did say, well, this was unfortunate because I'm on the Delaware County Board of Commissioners, some of us have been fighting spending a huge amount of county money to add an additional wing onto the county prison, but I'm afraid that this event with them not having enough room for you means we're going to lose that battle. And we just derided that idea that one day of sit-ins was really going to make them build a whole new wing to the prison. But mm-hmm. Anyway, I don't recall and that was just a comment. But in terms of actions, I think the faculty was good. Now, let me just say a couple of overarching things. We did spend a lot of time, and there were classes were missed to go into meetings and demonstrations and that kind of thing. But I would have to say that I, at some level, I learned as much about the real world, and especially about people who are from different backgrounds than mine. I learned as much from my work at in Chester as I did from my classes at Swarthmore. This whole thing was just so involving and so informative about, you know, especially about the down and out circumstances that Black people found themselves in, that I have no regrets about it, so I thought I would just add that. The other, now I'll tell you two things, and you can decide if you want to get in them or we should schedule a second call, but the main one, I think, is that after all that I've described was done, we sort of took our action straight out of the civil rights organizing book. There's no such book, but I mean, and I think wisely decided, well, we, and when I say we, sometimes I'm talking about just the Swarthmore students. Sometimes I'm talking about the broader movement in Chester. In this case, I'd say the broader movement, that what was needed was block organizing, community organizing. And so that's one thing that I could either try to describe some for you now, or we could do an additional phone call. And then the other is that I was arrested again in April in a, it was decided that we would try a new tactic of basically blocking intersections, trying to slow traffic down. It was not really a great tactic, but me and two Chester people got arrested, and that was much more individual. It was not part of 40 or 50 people, and I spent 3 days in jail, just in a jail cell. And so So I would say that the block organizing or community organizing is a large thing I'd like to tell you about, and then my second arrest would be important.
With, if you'd like to tell us a little bit more about the community organizing and kind of the intended goals of that, or the purpose of that as you saw it?
Yeah. Well, the purpose of it was to make our work more effective by having a well-organized an organization with really strong grassroots that would lead to more fundamentally changing things, rather. Not that getting a lousy elementary school replaced wasn't important, but, you know, to start a mass movement at the local level that could achieve more substantive change. So I found my file on that too. It's too bad we didn't have this conversation before the reunion. I could have brought all this stuff to you. And so anyway, I along with various other people was assigned one square block, literally, of Chester, and I was matched with two Black people who from that block who lived in Chester, and our goal was to organize, get people together from that block, find out what their primary issues were, and then help organize around that. So I actually have a survey we did on a housing survey and complaint form, facilities, conditions, pipes, toilets, maintenance. I guess I would say that although we were open to, I mean, it could have been any issues, but housing is often the, you know, it's some people's biggest problems and also more immediate. So like I'm looking at one leaflet that's 20 words. It's written, clearly produced at Swarthmore. Come join the fight against one bad housing conditions, two high rent. Meet at Larry Williams' house, 235 West 5th Street, Sunday, 3 p.m. So that went out, and then for some reason I have the sign-in sheet, so there were 20 people there. And so our two leaders, one was Larry Williams, who I just remember as being such a strong guy, solid. I keep saying physical things, but I mean he was a really great organized together guy. He worked a night shift at a steel plant in Wilmington, which was really a place that a lot of people went for good jobs. And then there was where's her name, because she was not I think her name was Bertha Johnson. So we had meetings, had people talk about housing issues. And I just remember, and this goes back to learning as much about you know, the world there. I spent a lot of time at Sylvia's house, just with, sometimes Larry was there, but it's like the three of us were the ones who were doing this action together, and I have, and she was very, very nice person. I enjoyed working with her and with Larry. So I remember two things. One is somebody coming to the door and Bertha giving him $5, and then he left. And she said, "Do you know what that is?" And I said, "No, I don't." She said, "That's my weekly payment of burial insurance for my kids." And if you look back in the history of the insurance industry, that was the first product that they were selling people, was just God, they just have the godforsaken right to, or not right, but that they give a child a decent burial if they died. So I, and so here, this was still going on in 1963, and who, nothing I had ever seen or thought about before. And then the other thing I remember is one time while we were talking, she was straightening her hair. So I just sort of watched her do that. And so that was just something I had never seen and was sort of amazed at. So I just remember taking the bus into Chester, doing some of this organizing. I see I have the name of some of the realtors. I can't say that I actually remember it leading to a rent strike, but that was often the case. Yeah, and so I have the notes of meeting one and so on and so forth. So that was our work to make this more of an ongoing movement. Now this is probably a good place to add this on. There were a lot of national groups involved in the freedom movement. There was the Northern Student Movement, there was SNCC, was the big one, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. There was the Northern Student Movement. There was, just now was coming the you know, the thought that, hey, some organizing should happen in the North, not just the South. And then there were a bunch of local groups not connected to a national organization. And so Chester Committee for Freedom Now was one such organization. So at one point there was a meeting of just in Chester, a meeting of people from 20 different organizations, maybe one or two people from each, and they wanted somebody from Swarthmore to come as part of the Committee for Freedom Now. The president of SPAC couldn't go, so I said, well, I'll go, and I went, and found myself sitting next to Malcolm X, which is pretty amazing. And this is the tragic thing about his death, is that this was a time when he had sort of revised his thinking and thought that local organizing of Black people around concrete issues and working with white people as part of that was okay. So that that was amazing experience. So so that, I think that's a once over on the block organizing. So I guess I should say I not only learned about a little bits of Black life, life of non people headed to college communities, but also about political action. And, you know, didn't Barack Obama get derided by Sarah Palin for being a community organizer, whatever that is she had said? So I thought, well, that's amazing that Obama has that background.
Did you feel that the work that you did in Chester was successful in whatever way you define success? Did you feel like it impacted the community, or, you know, that you saw some tangible change?
I saw some tangible change in terms of schools, and I saw the beginnings of change when it came to housing. But I've also seen I don't know if you could find this, but PBS did a story on Chester, a whole like half hour, I don't know what network it was, on Chester. And this was like 20 years later, I think. And so it just described life still being down and out for African Americans in Chester. And also it turning out, lo and behold, to be an area with perhaps the most toxic waste dumps of any place in the country or something, because of the shipbuilding industry. So so I do feel like in terms of dignity and developing leadership and affecting some issues on the ground, it was successful. I tell you the story of this second arrest either now or another time when we talk, but I will say that my involvement, and I would say the involvement of most of us who went through everything I've described here, pretty much only lasted my freshman year. And then after that, I became much more active in SDS and Swarthmore as an active chapter, but really we were focusing at that point more and more on Vietnam. And SDS was one of the first groups. Back then, it was not a controversy about Vietnam. It was thought to be good. The war hadn't been widened until 1965, but we started focusing more on that and going to anti-war marches in Washington, D.C. And then my senior year, we started, I don't know if you have any records of us, they're in the Swarthmore Peace Collection, if that still exists.
It does.
But yeah, we started the Swarthmore Draft Resistance Union, and those of us who were members signed a pledge to not serve in Vietnam if we were drafted. And I thought I have it right somewhere, right? Oh yeah, okay. We just, I mean, our statement was so short. If I got to do, I got the statement here. Shall I read it to you?
Sure.
It's a couple, okay. We are a group of Swarthmore students who, like many other people, are opposed to the war in Vietnam. We formed and joined the Swarthmore Draft Union, that's what it's called, because we feel it is our duty to make known our opposition to this war and the instrument of war, the draft. We are students who are attempting to put an end to what we believe are crimes of our government. One of the methods for affecting our aims will be demonstration. Many of our members will be participating in Saturday's spring mobilization. That was the one where a million people went to D.C. We'll be carrying signs with the name of our organization and passing out copies of this statement. One idea that's been presented to the members of the union is the possibility of going to local high schools to publicize our views and to start young men thinking about the problem of wars and the draft. We are open to any new methods of resistance anyone might care to offer. We hope that the meetings of the Swarthmore Draft Union will be times of discussion, of clarifying viewpoints and forming friendships with people who will be willing to help others in their resistance to the draft. We urge all members of the community to examine their consciences and beliefs on the questions of war, the draft, and Vietnam. Further, we urge all to come to one of our meetings and to consider joining Swarthmore Draft Union. Okay, well, that's not the statement. The statement was shorter than that, and it basically said a lot of that same background, and then said we will fight against and will not serve in the war in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And so that's the thing that I must have sent to the Swarthmore Peace Collection. So that was in my senior year. But in between those years, our focus on Chester had dissipated.
Yeah.
No doubt about that.
Can you go back and tell us about that second arrest you mentioned?
Yeah. Let me tell you one more thing about the Swarthmore, about the Chester, the broader Chester thing, and that was that as a sign of multi-issue politics, the Committee for Freedom Now put out a list of 37 demands. I won't read you all of those, but I can send you. I can't believe I still have this stuff. But
yeah.
I was a
history. We would love it if you wouldn't mind sending us anything you
yeah,
have.
I was a history major, so
yeah.
So you know there are 37 points, and they cover employment, housing, schools, medicine, police, voting, recreation, and news coverage. And so the Delaware County Daily News, oh, boy, we issued this fast, had this on November 15th and November 27th, and says CFFN formulates 37 point ultimatum. And anyway, that covers a bunch of things. And now this is also a good time to say, when I look at this, it reminds me that I'm not the one who made up the demands, for sure. But I am the one that typed them up on my typewriter, and so I have several carbon copies, and it's exactly what's in the list of demands. I don't know if I was doing any editing, and I raise this not to pat myself on the back, but just to say Swarthmore students were really involved in this, and in some ways that was good. I think I mentioned this at the beginning, but I became more and more alienated from our local political group, and I don't know how much that's a matter of disenchanted, that's the word I'm looking for. I'm not sure how much this was personalities, but there was some manipulation going on. There was meetings. This is when we talked about the meeting before the meeting and the meeting before the meeting before the meeting, basically to plan what should happen at that meeting. And there were times that Swarthmore students were not at all supportive, especially behind the scenes, of Stanley Branch and the leadership, but trying to, I would call it manipulating the way things went. Now, as members of the group, we had a right to participate, but who wrote these demands and who added to them? And there were times when notes were getting passed, famous scene where a note was getting passed, sort of saying how to disrupt or change the direction the meeting was happening, or that the leader, Stanley Branch, was just being charismatic but not suggesting the right things. And I don't feel good about that part, and that was part of what made me become less active in that particular part of the movement, and that would be a interesting group discussion to have, although two of the main leadership have died, so that would be hard, but there's plenty of people left. I also have to say, as a not just as a student but as a person at that point in my life, that what happened the next summer was the Mississippi Freedom Summer, and I don't recall that very many people from Swarthmore went. Some people might have, but I didn't want to go, because I wanted to, I did something. I wanted to drive across the country and spend the summer in California and have some, enjoy life in California and mm-hmm. all of that. So I drove across the country with Nick Kazan but I did, out in Berkeley, where my brothers were both graduate students, we did work on setting up the SDS chapter in Berkeley. So I don't want to make it sound at all like my political interest had dissolved, but the scene at Swarthmore had, and I don't know. I don't remember even considering going to Mississippi, and I'm not sure that I had the courage to do that, frankly.
Did other Swarthmore students go that you knew?
I can't think of one, but okay. That doesn't mean it didn't happen. Sure. And then, really what I should conclude, the part about the manipulation, it was only a few years later, 1965, that more and more the message coming from the leadership of the Black community, especially the part that we respected most, which was SNCC, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Long story short, the message was, hey, white people in our movement, you should go organize white people. And in fact, they are in many ways the problem. And also many white people are down and out and oppressed also, maybe not racially, but in terms of class and so on. So it, by that point, it would be less likely. There were still times that Black people and white people worked together, and when I later went on to do work with the Black Panthers, they had a different position on that. But that, I think, was also part of why I became less involved in civil rights stuff.
Yeah, so I think, you know, this feeling that you had of perhaps some sense that there was some manipulation going on, you think, is that something that you came about reflecting out as you were an adult, or you think that during those times that was also part of what made you a little bit less disinterested in the participation, or it was sort of a combination of both reflection as well as thinking about it during those times?
Let's see, I didn't quite get the distinction there.
The distinction is that whether you thought that this sense and this feeling that you have, that observation that you thought there was some manipulation going on from the students, was that something that you thought and reflected and sense as an adult thinking back on those times, or was that something that you saw while you were a student and maybe contributed to also not being as invested?
Yeah, got you. The latter. I was uncomfortable at times when I saw it, and then I felt it even more within our SPACs, with the Political Action Committee. I just felt like there were a couple of people who were leaders. They were manipulative even about our meetings, and I just started to feel kind of creepy about the whole thing. I didn't leave in a huff. I'm not sure I even left, to tell you the truth. I just stay a little involved in the Swarthmore scene in order to go to the National Head Start. Excuse me, I worked for Head Start for 20 years. Yeah. The National to SDS meetings. I needed to go as a representative of Swarthmore, so I stayed somewhat involved. But part of the reason I wanted to get away from it was that I felt manipulated. I just felt like the interactions within it were not something I was comfortable with.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the second arrest, and I have to tell you, this is, I dug out all these files yesterday and I've read some but not all of them, so I haven't read the one on the second arrest, but I can remember most of it. Okay, so we're blocking some intersection. This is like, you know, 10 of us or 20 of us, or not even 20, just sat in the middle of the intersection, blocked it. I don't think it was particularly that, I don't recall it being a white neighborhood or a black neighborhood or where we were. We did tie up traffic a little bit, but pretty soon after it started, a police car drove up. Okay, so most of these were young black guys who were active in the movement, but they had a strong instinct when a cop car showed up to run away as quickly as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't have that instinct, nor it all happened very fast. So long story short, I got arrested. Another young adult, Henry James, got arrested, and a young kid who I can hardly remember it. I can't remember his name. I probably have it in here. All got arrested. And so that was it. Three of us got arrested. Our compatriots in Chester and Swarthmore knew about it. This was in April of 64. We had an arraignment in sort of the lowest level Chester court. We were charged with various things. I can't actually remember what we were charged with, but it's all in here somewhere. So we got sent out to this same prison, Delaware County, whatever it was called. But well, first of all, the kid, I can't remember how old he was. So let's say 14, 16. I don't know what. He was separated off, and I'm pretty sure got off pretty quickly, or, you know, juvenile court's a whole other matter, so I can't. Oh, here's his name, Alonzo Watts, 15. Okay, I was pretty close. Mm-hmm. Hank James, 21, and I was 19. Yeah, there's a whole 3 pages I wrote of this, so I'll just cover it briefly, and then I'll send this to you. Hard to cover it briefly. Okay, so we got sent out there. So long story short, Hank and I are each in separate individual cells, so looking much more like a jail cell that you would see in a movie, double-decker or triple-decker. We were all kept in our cells 22 hours a day. They weren't dark. They had you know, bars on the front of them, electronically controlled gate. And we were each allowed out for 2 hours a day, not outside, but I wasn't a horror, but that was, so for 2 hours a day you could go out and walk around and socialize with people, which I did a fair amount of. And then when you're in prison, even if you're just haven't been charged or tried yet, people say, what are you in for? So we would say civil rights demonstration. Some, most people would say that's cool. And then other, what are you in for? Murder and attempted, you know, they were mostly in for much more violent things. But the conversation was friendly. I looked around for things to read. There was not much besides magazines. So I think the only thing that was readily available was a Bible. So, and I didn't grow up religious. Yeah, I read the Bible, I read some of this. I read Song of Solomon, which I thought, wow, that's pretty sexy for the Bible. But now this is not leading to a religious conversion, but just to say that. Okay, then I started to notice that a few guys were let out for a lot more than 2 hours a day. And they would, so they could wander around and talk to various people. And so one of them sort of took the habit of coming and talking in my cell. He was kind of a more kind of flashy guy, I think. Was he, I don't know what, I should not say this before I know, but I think kind of maybe part Brazilian. But he took an interest in me, which I couldn't quite understand. Now, I have a postcard in here from some of my Swarthmore compatriots saying, that's right, we had a strong principle in the civil rights movement that nobody gets bailed out till everybody gets bailed out. That's what Martin Luther King did. And so it would have been a lot easier for me to raise my bail, which was, I think, $2,000, than it would have been for Hank to get bailed out. But we said, no, it has to be both of us. Well, then this guy is taking more and more of an interest in me, and he was talking about when I got out, putting me up in, as I recall, in an apartment and being kind of his assistant or something like that. The nature of the business was not said, but and I had whatever a 1963 version of this, the guy was sort of after me, and maybe in a sexual way, I wasn't sure, but I thought, holy shit, I got to get out of here. this is scary. Mm-hmm. Nothing before that had been that scary. It was new and different, sort of a little scary, but so then the next morning, my cell door clicks open. There's nobody there, but you walk over to where the guy is, and long story short, you're out. So, and Hank's out too. So I thought, well, that, thank God. And there's also an article about this in the Phoenix. And I can just tell you that the date we got arrested was April 8th, 1964. And there's a picture, there's a little article just about my situation. One of the things I had to do was raise money for my defense, because I was charged with a lot of heavy duty stuff. I can see in here that did some fundraising. My family's lawyer in New York referred me to a lawyer, civil rights lawyer in Philadelphia, and so I had to raise like $2,000. So I have a letter in here from Mr. Beardsley, who is head of the philosophy department, talking about trying to help me raise money, and I had people raising money in New York. My father died when I was 13. These were friends of his who had been politically active with him, and my girlfriend at Sarah Lawrence, who didn't have a political bone in her body, except when she told me later that she had stood up on a table in the dining room at Sarah Lawrence and said, a brave civil rights worker in Swarthmore, Pennsylvania has been jailed and I'm raising money on his behalf, and passed the hat and then sent a check for $150. So that was amazing. Mm-hmm. And now to jump back, I forgot, to the incident itself. While we were getting arrested, a woman, I left out the key part of the story. While we're sitting there and had the traffic stopped, somebody in our demonstration just reared up with his right foot and just put his foot right through the side window of a car. So it smashed. And that's when the police came. And that's when everybody disappeared. So the cops come, they kind of detain us, you know, just standing on the street corner. They bring back they brought back a woman, or she came running around the corner, and she said, no, that's not them. It was two big, tall Negroes that did it. And there was me and Hank, who, as I recall, was fairly short. At that point, none of us knew what it was. So I guess we didn't actually see the guy smash the window. But then when we're in being arraigned just a few hours later, at the hearing, I don't quite have this right, but I think the police said that we had been identified as having been in the group that had smashed the car. On cross-examination, the woman passenger stated she did not remember saying that these two had not been the ones. So they got to this woman and convinced her to testify against us. So I raised a lot of money. The case went on into my sophomore year, and eventually the charges were all dropped. But it was a much more serious situation and much more of a isolated situation. I mean, I had support of my friends and political, you know, supporters, but it was a lot. I guess they were both intensive, but this was probably the most most intensive. So. Mm-hmm. So okay, let's see. We don't need to be done, but I think that's
Well, I think you've done a great job of covering a lot of things that we wanted to touch on, and we really appreciate all that. I think maybe lastly, if you could touch on any effects that this activism had on life back at Swarthmore and after Swarthmore, you know, how did this impact, how did this kind of activism impact the rest of your life? If you have any thoughts on that.
Sure. Let's talk about the, I can't think, let's see, in terms of how it affected the rest of my time at Swarthmore, it increased my political orientation to trying to change the world and make it a better place and paying more attention to the underlying forces. You know, we hadn't learned yet, but the thing I learned later on was you need to start looking at the corporate forces behind what's going on in Chester and what's Sun Oil and Scott Paper and, you know, where they fit in. We were aiming pretty far down the food chain, which in terms of grassroots activity was good, but in terms of looking at the nature of the power, the school board and the city council were really kind of just pawns. So in terms of later on, it certainly made me want to stay involved with the civil rights movement, which I did later on in other cities in New Haven and in Pittsburgh when I lived there. And so it was really cemented down for me at that point that I would be active in things. What it led to with me was I taught history at Quinnipiac College for 3 years. So by then it was the end of the decade and things had gotten much more militant, radical. I was able to avoid the worst of that part of it, but very involved as a faculty member and a student strike at Quinnipiac in New Haven. Did a lot of work on civil rights and anti-urban renewal stuff in New Haven, and then working it in Head Start, which I did for 20 years. A lot of people don't know this, but Head Start was really born out of the Mississippi Freedom Movement. It's where the first developmental, child development, preschool, and doing it comprehensively, both getting kids ready for kindergarten and addressing their nutritional and health needs and getting parents involved, especially the parent involvement part, all really came out of things where you could say co-opted by the Johnson administration, but in a good way, really, that's where it. So I've always been aware of that, and then I've been very active in trying to get better early childhood services available to all kids. I'd also say the whole thing just made me feel much more comfortable in diverse situations, and it felt like it gave me, you're never done, but gave me a good grounding in some other cultures besides the almost all white situation that I had grown up in. I left out little tidbits, keep coming, it's not part of the story. My roommate at Swarthmore, who was at the reunion, Bill Hauser, was African American. There's two parts of the story. One is, I got a letter from the Dean of Men in high school, and after, in the summer before I started at Swarthmore, saying, just wanted to let you know that your roommate Bill Hauser is a Negro, and I'm sure things will go fine. And that was sort of, you could think back in that letter and think, geez, that's weird. And yeah. But whatever it was, 30 years later, I'm going to taking my son to Occidental for college, and he got to the room first, and then in came his roommate, who was a black kid, with his parents, and I could just see in his parents' eyes, I felt like they were wondering. They were they were a little nervous, not in a, you know, in a strong way, about what kind of reaction was Danny and I guess me going to have to him having a black roommate. So I'm not critical of all of the, even though it's crazy that it had to happen, I'm not critical at all of the college sending me that letter, because they were just trying to avoid, you know, my mother, who wasn't actually with me, looking at this kid and saying, oh no, he's with a colored person. I got to go get this change. So that's just a sign of the times back then, I think. So, it had a profound effect on the rest of my life and made me not, you know, when I was in high school and it said, how would you like to imagine yourself in 20 years? This was actually on the Antioch application, but it could have just easily been Swarthmore. And I said, well, I picture myself married with kids and being president of the United States. And I'd like to picture myself that way. And my guidance counselor comes in and says, you can't say that. And I said, well, Mr. Lester, it doesn't say how do you predict, how would you guess you're going to be. It said, how would you like to imagine yourself? So, but by the time you're done with grassroots stuff and people's movements and all of that, I became a lot less mainstream and more of a activist. And even though I was successful in my work with Head Start, I certainly maybe this was also comes with being a little older, that I no longer was, you know, I was felt like I've still felt part of the movement for social change or insurgency or whatever you want to call it.
Well, this has been really great for us. I mean, I think we learned a lot about kind of life at Swarthmore within the political groups on campus as well as the administration, and that has given us a really interesting glimpse into that time period. And is there anything else that you'd like to share with us before we wrap up?
No, I'd hope. Are you going to talk to, why do I think the name Dan Pope? Or there were some people who came to the session just in May at the library, and so I'm hoping that you're in touch with some other people who are involved in all these activities.
We have a list of people that we are looking into interviewing over the next months, year. So I think we're going to get a really great, well-rounded picture at everyone's different experiences. And so we really appreciate you being one of the first.
Yeah, and I hope it's people. I know that a lot of people went on to do equally, you know, good things like tutoring and stuff. But I hope you have some people, they don't have to be from my class because many people were seniors this session, but people who were involved in these activities in fall of 63, spring of 1964.
And
then also, let's see, yours is mostly oral history, is that right? But I could, of the materials I have, which give much more detail, probably a little more accuracy, not based on 50-year-old memories. A couple things I have dual copies I could send you, and then some of the rest of it I could send you if you could just copy it and send it back to me. So
yes, please. But I was just about to ask you. So we'd love copies or whatever you're comfortable sending of the materials you mentioned. And some of them we may have, some of the Phoenix articles we have in our collection, but some other things that you mentioned, like pamphlets and leaflets, I think you had some arrest records. If you're willing to share, we'd really appreciate that. Ultimately, the project is intended to be an interactive digital exhibit that will allow visitors to the site to kind of interact with not only the oral histories, but also documents that help kind of illuminate or make some more points around what the oral histories cover. So the materials would be great. And we can talk more about the paperwork needed to put those documents online and share.
Yeah, that's so. What would it? Or you may not have the answer to this right now, but would it be? I can send. As I said, some of them I have duplicates, but most of them, if I send them to you, would you be able? I guess I should decide whether to.
Yeah, it's your call. So if you have duplicates of anything that you'd like to send us, and then if there are things that you would like us to scan and send back, just make a note of that. And we'll take care of that. And I can email you with my address later.
Yeah, okay, that sounds good. And yeah, so just let me know either on that specifically or anything else. That sounds great.
And then you have the release form I sent you. So if you don't mind signing that and sending that to either over email or I think I sent you the release form a couple of days ago to sign off on doing the interview.
Oh, okay. I forgot.
It's okay. I can resend it if you need it to.
That'd be the fastest. No, I can find it, Stephanie.
Okay.
Gotta not be too lazy here. Technologically challenged.
No, you did great. We really appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah, good.
Yeah,
okay.
Thank you very much, John.
Well, thanks. Good to talk to you. Bye, Roberta. Yeah.
We'll talk soon. Bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
Okay.
I also realized that I think it should be a problem, but...